I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, I'm back, mind rolling. Raghu, I am here with somebody who is so far across the other side of the world of ours, this very crazy world of ours right now, Tyson Yungaporta, and Tyson lives in Australia, in Melbourne, right?
Yeah, that's where I'm staying right now.
Welcome. Great to have you.
Yeah, good to see you.
So, I could go through a whole thing and read off of the thing I got from the publicist around the book. He's written a beautiful book. I mean, very rich. Called Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. And, but I would rather, if you don't mind, and I know you probably, because you're probably doing a lot of the, a lot of these kind of things lately, maybe not a podcast, but just I'd like to hear your story growing up, where you grew up.
Okay.
I mean, please.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'm not really into promotion and all that sort of thing.
Good.
Don't worry about blurbs and all that kind of stuff. Let's just talk. Sounds good to me. I had a really rough childhood. I don't particularly enjoy revisiting all that. I know it's a different thing in the United States. People like to go, and then when I was 12, my uncle did this, and it kind of just goes on. And then like people write books about it, and then they're like an idiot and they tell it again, and then they're like, I don't know.
Yes,
I think America likes to re-traumatize itself quite a bit, but I'm not really into that. But yeah, I don't know. It was fairly crappy, but I grew up all over the place. I was actually born here in Melbourne, but moved out. I just moved away when I was a little baby, so I don't remember anything about it. So I spent most of my time up north and in Queensland, and just moved around. I was in construction camps most of the time. I don't know if you know what a construction camp is, but it's when they build infrastructure sort of out on the frontier of things, gold mines and dams and the stuff that kills the world, like all that kind of thing. Where they have like hundreds of sort of single men just sort of slowly rotting in caravans and stuff like that. So I grew up in those places mostly. You know, no shoes and, you know, run around like a little bit feral and all kinds of stuff going on.
Your mother and father?
Yeah, I sorry, my phone went off here.
Okay.
Yeah, I lost them. Yeah, just, I don't know. It's just a really crappy story. I don't really like going into it. You probably see my face now. I'm starting to feel a bit no good about it. They were from different places, and there was, you know, different family lines and bloodlines and stuff like that. I ended up reconnecting with one of those, and, you know, was building that relationship when I was a younger fella, and it ended up that didn't go very well, you know, really very highly dysfunctional sort of people. And so, you know, lots of, you know, heroin use and stuff like that. And it just kind of, it was all a bit ugly. People keep looking for this like redemptive story, you know, and everything was bad. And now you're this wonderful thing and, you know, you can do it. Like that kind of thing. That's not really my story, you know. I'm not a very impressive kind of person, or, you know, a tale of you know, wonderful things or anything. You know, but for more than half my life, I've been adopted part of the Uplitch clan from Western Cape York. It's a law thing that we have in Australia, you know, traditional law. Like adoption is a very enduring, all encompassing thing. So I guess there's different kinds of adoption. Like you might be informally adopted just for the amount of time that you're there. If you go and visit a community, just so that you come under the laws of that place. There's that, but then there's like full customary adoption, which is different, and that's been recognized in even the, you know, High Court in Australia and all that, like a lot of the native title. So the Mabo case, I don't know if you ever heard of that. That's a famous one. And that was based on customary adoption, so people claiming land through, you know, adoptive links. Because when you have that full adoption, you have to take on those genealogies. So because I lost my family as a young fella, and I didn't have any other family, you know, and so I was an Aboriginal person that was not really linked very well to, you know, the traditional homelands or traditional tribal peoples. You know, I had like a troubling relationship with some of those, and people, you know, people were, you know, passing away all the time as well, and it was very volatile. I think the last cousin and auntie that I had really strong relationship with from that old heritage for me, they were very unwell, very suffering, and I don't know, so I kind of had I don't know. Like, so, you know, I watched I've never told anyone this. I watched my cousin die and, you know, sit with her in a hospital, and nobody else in the no one else in the family sort of would even go to a funeral or anything like that. It was just all, you know, I think people have a romanticized ideal about, you know, finding family when you've lost family, and that there'll be this homecoming, and that, you know, some salt of the earth fella will be there wiping off his greasy hands on his overalls, and there'll be the big hug, and it'll all be like that. It's just not like that. It's pretty shitty, actually. people are always like, I don't know. I used to tell this story all the time, and all the details and names, and I'd have a little cry, and people really liked that, because that's what, I don't know, that's what we always do. So in Indigenous Australia, that's pretty much what we write. You know, most of the books, if you get books written by Indigenous Australians, it'll be their freaking life story, their miserable, crappy life story, and how they overcome all their disadvantage to get to finally write a book. And people go, wow, they wrote a book. And, you know, that's where it goes to. And then they've got to try and explain why they're not very dark. Because that's another thing, especially if it's an international audience, because, you know, most of us are not dark skinned anymore here, but, you know, but we still retain our connection to land, and we retain that assertion that we've never ceded sovereignty, because we haven't. These lands have never been ceded. There's never been a treaty or anything like you guys have over there, you know. So we just, yeah, we're kind of this unknown, unknowable sort of thing that's generally only knowable in certain little ways through certain little formats. You know, it's like, there's this self-narrative genre, and that has a structure. And you see that repeated over and over again. And I've been guilty of it. I did that for about a decade. That's pretty much all I did. You know, I'd have to do keynote speeches, you know, like I was in. So, you know, I'm doing cognitive psychology, and then I'd have to do a keynote speech, you know, on cognition, on Indigenous cognition. And the first half of it would just be my shitty life story. And everybody going, oh, my God, that's amazing. That's just amazing. Oh, my God, what you've been through, you know, and to come out the other side is so inspiring. And I just don't find it inspiring. So I had a mentor who was an academic, Torres Strait Islander academic, who said to me, boy, you got to stop doing that. You got to stop doing that. We all have to stop doing that. It's no good. You know, it's just invasion porn. You know, it's colonial porn for people to look at, and it's embarrassing, it's shame, and you have to stop doing it. It gets in the way. He's saying, did you notice that nobody heard what you said in the second half of the keynote? What were all the comments about your crappy life story? Just let it be. And you know, and I found that when I stopped telling the story and I stopped even thinking about it, then I stopped re-traumatizing myself, and I actually got a lot happier. And I got a lot more productive. I was able to, you know, produce a lot more things for the colony and the whole neoliberal system, which, you know, it means I get more rewards. I get to like have a phone that works, roughly, but not a computer that works, obviously, because I can't make this microphone go. But, you know, I think the more I do the positive thinking and smile, I guess the more productive I'll become and the more rewards I'll get. Who knows, I might write another book yet.
Yeah. If you do a book, yeah, that's along those lines, it'll work really well here in America.
Yeah, positive thinking. My favorite book ever from the States, though, was that Smile or Die. It was by, what's her name, Barbara Ehrenreich or something. Yeah, and the subtitle was How Positive Thinking Fooled America and the World. And she traces the history of positive thinking, and it's really terrifying. So anyway, I love that book. People call me a pessimist, but you know, are you a real glass is half empty kind of person? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I just want to know what's in the bloody glass, you know.
That's it.
What's in the glass?
So at the I just want to refer to some stuff in the book. I mean, you have traveled with so many incredible people, so many adventures into the, shall we say, the truth in my lexicon. And my experiences all took place in India when I was a young man. And I have been going back and forth to the most of my life. So this is
like in a Ram Dass kind of way, or in a
exactly. He was a teacher and friend, and you know, months ago. I didn't know that.
Him specifically.
Huh?
Specifically, you knew him.
I met him.
Oh my goodness, that's mad.
I met him in Montreal, where I'm from, Canada.
Quebec. I'll be damned.
And and then followed him back to India when he went back the second time, and met that being that his guru, Nimkaroda Baba, the man who signed it. And from then, my whole life went, you know, I don't know, was going sideways pretty well.
Yeah.
Started having forward momentum, shall we say.
Okay. Hmm.
So just a little something. The stories that define our thinking today describe an eternal battle between good and evil, springing from an originating act of sin. But these terms are just metaphors for something more difficult to explain, a relatively recent demand that simplicity and order be imposed upon the complexity of creation, a demand sprouting from an ancient seed of narcissism that has flourished due to an imbalance in human societies. Yeah, talk about narcissism. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm not that familiar with politics in Australia, but I do believe you have something of a Trump kind of brother over there. Is that the narcissism?
They're all Trump brothers over here. even the liberal ones, although we say it backwards, like liberal over here means conservative, because of, you know, liberalism and all that. Americans are funny. So I don't know, well, let's start with what was the core of the thing that you learned from Ram Dass?
The thing
that transformed you, that first switched you, like, what the general area of the core of that message,
in my own words, and ultimately over time, it was about the more that you are focusing on the little mini me that you are telling your story about, you are lost. And when you start to realize that and start to move out of that into the interconnectivity and realizing it's the we and it's the serving of the we that is why we are here on this planet, that encapsulates very generally what has happened over this time.
Now, yeah.
Pleasant, because that attachment we have to that story is so pernicious.
And
it's like a glue, like crazy glue that crazy glue mind.
Yeah, you can't even start an interview with somebody without making sure they have room to tell their crappy little story. You see what I'm talking about?
Exactly.
You know, and it's just the ultimate narcissism. And the idea of a life story, we've never had that in human history. No one ever sit around a campfire and told their life story. You know, we tell stories about things that have happened. You know, we tell stories about creation. You know, we tell stories that will help us understand things and learn things and connect. But having to listen to, like, Lucille sitting there, and then when I was 9 years old, I had to go down to the bay. It's like, nobody wants to hear that. you know, and there's a reason for that. And there's a reason for the boredom that comes with that as well. You know, there's all these mechanisms that are screaming at us, get your eye off yourself. Get your eye off yourself. You're not very important. Now, I think what you went through with Ram Dass would have been some kind of, always, you would have experienced it as a rite of passage. Now, always these rites of passage as human beings, and we come, it's all the same. Okay, so human beings for most of human history have been living pretty much the same culture and the same pattern all around the world. And so all around the world until very recently, the tiniest blip in time, around the age of 14, 15, you would have experienced that rite of passage. And that rite of passage would have taught you a few things. But the most important thing that it would have taught you is you are not very important. And that's the first blow. Because mama's told you you're important, or your aunties, grandmas, everyone around you growing you up as a baby. It's giving you that, I'm important. And then, boom, you get that slap. You're not very important. And it hurts.
Big slap.
And you go through pain with it. But then you get realized that you've had those cascading realizations, right? And there is a structure to them. You know, it's like, there's a few comforts in there because, okay, so I'm not very important, but then nobody else is really that important either then, individually, you know. So therefore, nobody's better than me. I'm not above anyone else, but nobody else is above me either. And so out of that, all of a sudden, your mind starts to extrapolate governance systems and ways of being together that are a lot more interdependent, interrelated, and through that you sense the connectedness of all things in that group. And then that spreads out to other entities, animals, rocks, trees, all these things. I am not greater than that tree. I'm not greater than that rock, you know? Yeah. But even that mountain over there, he's not greater than me. You get all this, and there is a series of cascading realizations, you know, because you start to, and where you end up with, the point that you end up in order to go on to the next, because there are, every 15 years, there are new rites of passage to go through in human cultures. So you come to the, you know, when you come to the end of that first one, you realize something like, you know, and we don't want to do spoiler alerts for people who haven't done it. But it's kind of, you end up, well, if I'm not important, okay, I'm not important, but I belong to something important. You know what I mean? I'm part of something important, you know? And then as you go through your life, you take on different roles, you know, in that important thing that you belong to. Yeah. And that thing is, I don't know, you might think of it as a dharma or something like that, yeah. You know, but you have a role and a duty, yeah. And you carry it forward through your life.
None of this happened with
new knowledge.
Because none of this happened with me. I mean, as you went through that rite, as you just talked about, and I did, and I was just questioning everything.
Yeah.
What is this I have to conform to fit in? And it was only through psychedelics that I suddenly saw more clearly the interconnectivity of everything. The fact
so that did you know Timothy Leary as well?
I didn't. I didn't know Tim. I knew him more through Ram Dass, although I saw him just on the, you know, in public, but no, yeah. I don't know him personally. Yeah.
This is so exciting to meet a contemporary of these people who was around and who was experiencing it, you know.
Yeah.
I've never met anybody who was connected to that circle before.
Oh, really?
It's really exciting because I think it's there are ripples that come out from things like that. I think there was a basin of attraction around those two men.
Yeah.
You know? So in complexity theory terms, you know, you have these basins of attraction. And I think a lot of things happen around there, and there were a lot of ripples that went out into the world. And those ripples, some were terrible. You know, a lot of the creation of the internet came out of those guys and what they did. And you know, a lot of the people who built the internet were building on those ideas. You know, the very, you know, little windows and hyperlinks and things that we're using right now to talk to each other, you know, these were things that were found through trips, psychedelics. You know, these were ideas. People were trying to recreate a dreaming world that they'd skated around the edges of.
Well, Einstein did this without any tripping, right?
He did. Yeah. Thought experiments. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so listen, just to move a little bit forward, because there's something, I just read this thing, I went, wow. When did you write this? A couple of years ago or something?
Maybe? No, last year.
Last year, okay.
Yeah.
Well before what we're going through right now. And here's you say, there's a pattern to the universe and everything in it, and there are knowledge systems and traditions that follow this pattern to maintain balance, to keep the temptations of narcissism in check. But recent traditions have emerged that break down creation systems like a virus, infecting complex patterns with artificial simplicity, exercising a civilizing control over what some see as chaos. The Sumerians started it, the Romans perfected it, the Anglosphere inherited, the world is now mired in it. The war between good and evil is in reality an imposition of stupidity and simplicity over wisdom and complexity. That's beautiful, man. I love that.
Thank you. People, I mean, that's the gotcha moment for a lot of people. I've had that passage read out to me before.
Really?
In radio programs and stuff in Australia here. And they don't read it the same way as you.
Oh?
They read it kind of as an accusation, like they're reading back.
Oh.
Something in a court case or something, and then you said,
really?
Oh, you're saying that Western civilization is stupid. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. So it was nice to hear it read in a positive light. That
totally, it's not positive; it's truth.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is. It is truth. Order from chaos. Sorry, I still got the Latin inscription in my head. You know, it's a motto that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think it's worthwhile talking a little bit about when you talk about complexity.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. You know, we're talking about wisdom and complexity. How do they?
Yeah.
And what are you really talking about with complexity?
Well, there's a difference between the complex and the complicated.
Mm.
You know, so our complex system is self-organizing, and it has this kind of homeostasis where it will self-correct. You know, so if damage is done to the system, then the system will heal itself. You know, so you know, I don't know if I bump you on the head with this, not too hard, just like, I don't know, just about like that hard, it's gonna hurt, you know, it's gonna leave a mark. But it'll come good, because your body is a complex system, so your body will heal itself eventually. That lump will go down, you know. If there's any blood, you know, that'll come and heal it and all that sort of thing. But if I did that to this laptop here, if I got this phone and I hit that the same way, that's not going to fix itself, because this is a complicated system, this one. You know, so it requires constant intervention, maintenance, upgrading, you know, tinkering. You got to tinker with it. So one of the big examples I use is the International Space Station. That space station is a complicated system. And they got to work real hard to stop that thing from just falling apart and crashing back through the atmosphere. But the fungus that's growing inside it is a complex system. There's a fungus currently overtaking the International Space Station. Yeah. And it's a biotic, you know, self-organizing complex system. So they can't kill it, because every time they invent a new poison to try and kill it, it comes back stronger.
Little like you the know. Virus that's going on now?
Yeah, the virus I see is something else. The virus is not a pathology in and of itself. This COVID-19, along with all the other viruses, because lots come out all the time. It's every 10 minutes there's another virus. It just keeps coming. And that's coming from disruption of the landscape. So basically, we've destroyed most of the ecosystems on the planet, or they're in a state of extreme stress, even the best of them. The ones that you go on holidays and take photos and think of as untouched wilderness. These are all highly stressed landscapes. Now, there are animals in those highly stressed landscapes who are under stress and in extreme distress, and who are like refugees. They're fleeing, you know, the poisons, the toxins, the destruction, the ecosystems that are falling in these cascading effects, and they're having to flee those places. Or they're struggling in those places desperately to survive. So those animals are sick. So sick systems, they produce pathogens. And of course, as they're fleeing from those environments, they infect other species with the pathogens that are being produced through that sickness in the land. So as I see this this disease at the moment as it's more of a comorbidity issue rather than a pathogen in and of itself.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much. I mean, look what's happening environmentally around the world.
It's
extraordinary. So it's like, I have a friend that we just did a little virtual retreat past weekend. His name is, he's a scientist. His name is Bruce Damon. And I think you'd enjoy, I should introduce you guys at some point, because I think you enjoy each other. But he just said, yeah, this is Gaia in relation to the virus.
Yeah.
A little smack in the head, like you just demonstrated. It's a bop that's going to hurt, but it's going to recover. And hopefully in that tap, love tap, there will be an awakening, we hope. We look at it positively. There is some awakening going on.
Mm. Yeah.
I've said I just walk up the street, take my daily walk, and people are walking by, nicely distanced, and we look each other in the eye and hi. And it's like, hi, here we are.
Yeah.
We're in this together.
Yeah.
That wasn't happening before. So,
yeah.
But this is more of a love. This ain't the 1918 plague, the bubonic plague, you know. It's not Ebola. But we hope we get it. But as I read through your book, Tyson, there's so much. The fact that we're dealing with this incredible narcissism throughout, not just
yeah.
but people, but us, that is something that really has to change.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It has to change.
And look, I mean,
some of these people is, yes, we're going to have to deal with these idiots at one point. They will be dealt with at one point or another.
Yeah. But then at the same time, it's, I mean, you can't engineer those changes. Or dealing with all these things are things that, these are things that can't be designed by a single mind or a committee. So I talk a lot in the book about that, the complex human systems that we need to develop in order for these solutions to emerge and the new systems of transition to emerge. You know, these have to be quite organically emerging by groups of people, massive groups of people, you know, behaving like all like little nodes do in a complex adaptive system. There are a lot of people trying to trying to engineer these things. at the moment. I don't know if you ever came across the Game B community. So no. There's a lot of tech people, you know, who came out of the Timothy Leary side of things rather than the Ram Dass side of things, you know, the people who built the internet basically, and then have found that it did not fulfill its promise, you know, because they basically tried to tinker that system and to try and recreate the indigenous dreaming world that they'd encountered on these trips. But they had no framework, no society or culture that was grounded in a landscape and in responses to the land and to the patterns of creation. So they were kind of these tourists. You know, when you see like the tourists in Fiji or whatever walking around drinking out of coconuts and they're like, yeah, we'll take these coconuts back and the umbrellas and the hibiscus. And I'm going to have a lei and I'm going to bring this back into my life. I'm going to say aloha every day or whatever because they've been to Hawaii. It's kind of like that. So I don't know if you see the Game B community on Facebook, they're all really smart people, who are still, they're trying to tinker these systems. And they're coming out of that, you know, these are all contemporaries of Timothy Leary. That's why I said I was really excited to meet somebody who'd been involved in that because I've been following these people for a while because they have really good theoretical perspectives that are grounded in complexity and they get into a lot of game theory and, you know, co-evolutionary fitness surfaces is about the closest thing in Western science that I can find to what I'm talking about in our way. But these are still very young, very new philosophies, you know, and they're really struggling to try and design it. They think their mind is here, you know?
That's it.
But their mind, so they still have that narcissism of like thinking that their individual brain and mind and then, you know, the things that they can communicate with other people and design together is going to solve the problems. But it won't because they're complex problems. And using complicated, you know, philosophies and theoretical tools to solve complex problems is only ever going to be nibbling around the edges, you know? Hey, you said, Guy, I wanted to, before I get away from this, I'm changing the subject, but Gaia, the term Gaia, do you know where it comes from?
Greek.
Greek? Because have you ever read about the Roman wedding ceremony?
No.
Like, so the Romans had a wedding ceremony where they would call each other, because Gaia is the feminine of Gaius. So you know how all the emperors, they were all like, you know, Julius Caesar was Gaius. You know what I mean? They all had that name first, a lot of them, you know. And the name's still there today in English, Guy and Guy in French and all that sort of thing. Yeah. I think it's Gaetano in Italian. Like it's a, you know, right across the Western world, it's still a name. But that's it. So the line in the wedding ceremony was, I am God. So the woman would say, I am Gaia to your Gaius. And the man would say, I'm Gaius to your Gaia, you know, and then they would get married and then he would be paterfamilias and have power of life and death over her. Like, you know, so within their little domus in their house, he could kill her if he wanted. He could crucify her in the living room and he was perfectly within his rights. So that's who Gaia is. And there is that patriarchal relation to the planet that we just can't escape in the DNA of this language that we're all forced to speak. Everybody, you know, even to the point of when we try and think of the spiritual name for this planet that we're living on, this sacred being, the best we can come up with is, you know, the name of a Roman wife who didn't own property and could be beaten to death by her husband at any moment. You know, or just thrown out in the street because he wants a younger one. No, I want a 12-year-old wife now. You know, like they could just do that. And it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of the way that we treat the earth. And it comes down to this seed of narcissism. And that's a story I can tell you. It's a story that you could tell me because every tradition on the planet has this original sin, you know, this narcissistic moment of when this this thought that's the origin of all human suffering started to come to the front of our consciousness. This suspicion that I am greater than, I'm better than you. Ah, I'm better than him. I'm better. I'm amazing. I'm better than this land. I'm better than that tree. That tree exists for me. You know, that woman exists for me. Now, those are my children. You know, it all human suffering comes from that. Because and then, you know, people start killing each other. Cain slays Abel and all that sort of thing because they're like, no, I'm better than you. No, I'm better than you. And so in our way, that one of our stories around that, see, my totem is Brolga, and Brolga and Emu are always fighting in a lot of our dreaming stories. So I know all these stories about Emu, and in a lot of them, at the start of creation, this narcissism enters into the pattern of creation. It's a seed. It's a seed of evil that Emu brings in, where Emu thinks that he's better than everyone else and shows off, tries to show off, tries to trick people, tries to harm people in order to show his dominance, you know? And it just goes like that. Yeah, it's that original sin of narcissism. And it's basically, I think it's the source of all suffering, all human suffering.
Yeah, you know what the Tibetans call it? They have a good word for it. Self-cherishing.
Self-cherishing. yeah.
But I want to read a little more because it's not weird to sit here reading your book to you, but I can't help.
Yeah, that's all right. I like the way you read it. It's
So we're talking about containing the excesses of malignant narcissists is a team effort. Love that on its own, right? When you were just talking about it. The combination of social fragmentation and lightning fast communication today, however, means we have to deal with these crazy people alone as individuals butting heads with narcissists in a lawless void, and they are thriving unchecked in this environment. Engaging with them alone is futile. Never wrestle a pig, as the old saying goes. You both end up covered in shit and the pig likes it. The fundamental rules of human interaction do not apply to them, although they weaponize those rules against everyone else. The basic protocols of Aboriginal society, like most societies, include respecting and hearing all points of view in a yarn. Okay. That's number one. It's the number one thing that we need right now, include respecting and hearing all points of view. Narcissists demand this right then, refuse to allow other points of view on the grounds that any other opinion somehow infringes their freedom of speech or is offensive. They destroy the, this is just like, I mean, you could just watch Trump on, I mean, we have to sit there and watch this guy on TV. They destroy the basic social contract of reciprocity, which allows people to build a reputation of generosity based on sharing to ensure ongoing connectedness and support. Shattering this framework of harmony with a few words of nasty gossip. They apply double standards and break down systems of give and take until every member of a social group becomes isolated, lost in a Darwinian struggle for power and dwindling resources that destroy everything. I mean.
Then they move on to the next.
Yeah, this little parenthesis you have here, you know, allowing people to build a reputation of generosity based on sharing to ensure ongoing connectedness and support. Is that not step number one for us to share out? And if you ask me about what I got from my whole experience, you know, in the formative years of my life, being with this particular being and hanging out with Ram Dass and all of that, you just said it. That's a key thing. He was all about that. Caring. He could. I mean, he was told, this is, people are going to go, Robbie, you're going to tell that story, yarn again. But I'm with you right now. I don't really care.
Yeah, yeah.
He was told by his guru, do not, when he went back to the West, do not talk about me when you go back. Fully knowing, of course, that's all Ram Dass was going to do. So recently I said to him, why did you do that? You were just talking about it. You came back and you were doing talks. And he said, I couldn't help myself. I couldn't help myself. I had this jewel. How could I not share that? And so that spirit is what has infected everyone who's come into contact with him over these decades. Is that spirit of generosity and sharing, which you so beautifully spelled out in this little thing you just read.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, I get, it's hard to resist gurus. And I guess gurus are always trying to resist becoming gurus. Like if they're just a person of knowledge.
I mean, you know. But
like, it's like we have this, you know, in these civilized societies, there's this imperative, you know, and we're all in it now. And we all follow that pattern. We seek to elevate. Like, you know, people don't say, what are you reading? They say, who are you reading?
Mm.
Have you ever noticed that? Yeah. Like, it's like the messenger is more important than the message. Mm. It's that branding thing that I said from the start that I really want to resist, you know, myself. Because, you know, I'm really unimportant. And I guess in my communities here, I'm a very marginal person, you know. In the mainstream community and in the Aboriginal community, I'm not a very elevated person. So I don't speak for any of this knowledge or anything. So I don't want to, you know, you always want to resist that. Your people always want to elevate you. And I try really, like you can see my guru in this book, hey, it's that old man Juma who provided a lot of the symbols.
Yeah.
In the same way as you've got that one behind you, reminiscent of a mandala.
Yeah.
And it's a similar tradition that we have here.
Yeah.
And that's what the name of the book, Sand Talk, is about, that tradition of drawing in the sand. You know, a lot of these things. And a lot of the more ceremonial ones, like the Tibetans and like the mandalas that you would know, you know, these are always temporary images, you know, in cultures all around the world. Like these are created and a lot of work go into them, but then they're erased immediately afterwards.
Mm.
I guess so that they're not cherished. You know, and yeah. elevated in the same way as that the people who are doing them are not being cherished and elevated and are resisting that.
Yeah.
You know, Juma is really hard not to elevate him. But I work really hard to make sure that I'm not.
But that's
well
self-referential. I mean, you are elevating him. He has no care. He has no self-reference about who he, quote unquote, is or isn't. I mean,
yeah.
Being that I sat in front of, it was a one-way street. He wasn't doing anything. He wasn't thinking he needed to do anything. There was nothing like that kind of interpersonal stuff going on.
Yeah.
Whatever I did, I was following the story, which included the whole Hindu tradition and gurus. And I'm from the West, and I'm making my way over there to get the wisdom of the universe and save everything. Whatever the whatever I was doing, right?
But like Alexander the Great, just following that. Yeah.
There was nothing going on in this being whatsoever that resounded with any of that, you know.
Yeah.
At all. But you talk about it here. You talk about something, not that in a particular way, but I really love the way that you talk about how we separate ourselves. Either somebody's greater, somebody's lesser, and so on. Respect must be facilitated by custodians. But there is no outsider imposed authority, no quote unquote boss, no quote unquote dominion over it. While senior people ensure that the processes and stages of coming to higher levels of knowledge are maintained with safety and cohesion, there is no centralized control in Aboriginal societies. This is something we can't understand, you know, Western mind coming from these privileged things. We can't. Knowledge systems are centralized. And this could be why they have so far been unable to engage in dialogue with indigenous knowledge systems in the development of sustainability solutions. I think this is a key thing in the book. Certainly around sustainability. Maybe just talk about that a little bit, please.
Yeah. I mean, well, everybody recognizes now that you know, centralized authority and centralized control systems are not productive, that they're extremely fragile and they're not adaptive enough to be able to respond to changes, disasters, etc. And anybody who didn't realize that, you know, a month ago is realizing it now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you've got, I mentioned that Game B community before, you know, there are a lot of thinkers out there, and especially Silicon Valley guys and everything, they're obsessed with decentralizing, like creating tech for decentralizing these systems.
Yeah, blockchain.
What they don't realize is that the need for these centralized institutions in the first place, it was about issues of trust. So they're not trying to resolve those issues of trust and create human systems and communities that are trusting and transparent. Instead, they're trying to maintain those mistrustful communities and try and impose some tech solution to take that centralizing control out of human hands. So yeah, blockchain, as you mentioned, it's there to, you know, all right, well, we need this mechanism in place, you know, to resolve the issues of trust. You know,
what is that?
In these boxes that just suck energy and require so much more energy to cool, and like really now at this moment when we're teetering on the brink of, you know, global catastrophe caused by this burning of energy in the first place, that's our solution. It's not to find ways to trust each other. It's to find a tech solution to the trust issue. So that's why these centralized things are coming. But and people know they need to go, but they don't know what to replace it with. But basically, you know, Aboriginal society has had tens of thousands of years where we've basically just focused on the narcissism problem. And we've just focused on, you know, those cascading ideas coming from that, what I told you earlier in that first ritual, that first rite of passage where you realize you're not important. You know, there are governance systems that come out from that realization, you know. And so basically we've spent, you know, tens of thousands of years, longer than anyone else on the planet, developing governance systems that are decentralized. Well, they're not even decentralized because they weren't centralized in the first place. They're just not centralized systems. These are distributed, you know, models of being, you know, and models of governance. And they do scale. So, you know, a lot of, you know, so you keep coming across this idea like the Dunbar number. You've seen this one. That's the same thing that's coming out. A lot of these theories like systems theory, game theory.
Yeah,
all that sort of thing. Your game theorists are all the ones who are trying to design these decentralizing models, you know, from the tech community. And, you know, they had this idea that you're always going to end up with, you know, defectors within a group once it passes the Dunbar number of 150 people. So you can have a transparent society of 150 people, with distributed governance models and decentralized and all that sort of thing. But once it passes that Dunbar number of 150, it doesn't scale beyond that. But in Aboriginal Australia, we did scale it. We were able to scale it. So yes, we did live in these smaller groups of up to 150. However, we had a lot of interaction, you know, between the groups. We weren't isolated for all of that time. We were more of an anarcho-syndicalist kind of thing, you know, and it's the syndicalist that's important. So we had a very interdependent economy where we were traveling all over Australia. If you look at an Aboriginal map of Australia, you'll see 500 different territories. small territories, each one with a different language. And you'll see that everywhere. You'll see that still in the Caucasus Mountains, you know, who Caucasian people were named from, you know. They still have that linguistic diversity there. You can still see it around the world in places that remain undisturbed. You know, there is diversity and interdependence, and you don't have that expansionism going on. You know, it is scalable. It is possible to achieve this kind of interdependence. And where does that pattern come from? What's the secret to it? What's the design? It's basically about the big message in the book, which is just being like your place. Mm. You live in a bioregion and you follow the patterns of that bioregion. So that bioregion shapes your language. It shapes your laws. You know, the stories, the creation stories, the creation processes, the patterns of creation in that place will shape the way you live. It'll shape the way you interact with other groups who have different patterns. You know, the patterns of the land and the complex biotic systems that you live within, these are the patterns you follow. And I guess as a beginner, if you were starting out, you might, you know, you might begin with biomimicry principles as a way to do that. So I see that shape behind your head, and I'm reminded of the COVID-19 virus.
It's actually it's in Be Here Now.
Okay.
It's his thing of the heart cave.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I think it's the virus, the COVID-19, is basically a ball of a spiky ball.
Yeah.
Like that. And you know, and it operates by attraction. The spikes on that ball are attracted to the proteins on cells.
Mm.
And they stick to them. I guess if you were going to learn something from this virus, you might think about, wow, how can I make myself more sticky? If I'm this you know, funky ball of spikes, what surfaces do I want to be attracted to? What surfaces do I need to be attracted to? And then when I connect with those other surfaces, in what ways am I going to transform those things I'm connecting with? But more importantly, in what ways am I going to allow those things that I'm connected to transform me?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because it's that back and forth, and we went away from it, and I guess we'll come back to it, that reciprocity we were talking about earlier that you mentioned, you know. Yeah, you have these reciprocal, mutual interactions where that reciprocal altruism, for example, you know, you do things for each other and for community with no expectation of return. However, at the same time, you're also accruing almost credits, social credits, in doing that. And we call that reputation. You know, you end up with a reputation for generosity. And these are things that it's like you guys call it 401k, you know, you're building your 401k of generosity.
Yeah.
And that's these are things that will ensure you're also looked that's after. Yeah.
Listen, so I can't, you know, we're getting close to the end here, taking your time, but I can't leave it without, we've talked a lot, you know, we've talked about the big ill of narcissism.
Yeah.
And the other big ill that's a theme in the book that needs to be mentioned is the flawed relationship between civilian men and women is the basic unit of our enslavement in the global economic system that has come to dominate our lives. There is no way men would submit to the labor we undertake without needing to attract and then support our women, or worse, without the promise of being able to dominate them by accumulating capital and forcing them into dependence. 90% of the world's wealth is owned by men. Most of the wages in the world go to men, while women do about 2/3 of all the work, most of which is underpaid or not paid at all. Sustainability is an impossible dream in this unevenly gendered system. So it is worth revisiting the idea of liberating ourselves from it.
Yeah.
Well said, my new friend.
It's very important. It's so easy to sideline these things when you're in this state of emergency, you know. It's like, oh, there's bigger things to worry about right now than feminism. You know, we need to worry about climate change. It's like, well, you know, we need to get things right in the most important. I mean, that's the other thing about Aboriginal society. It's built around that fundamental, the central relationship in Aboriginal society is that mother-child relationship and the support of women, you know, in that role. And in that relation is the center of all things, you know, and it needs to be honored. It needs to be respected. Women need to be honored and respected. If you don't have that, then, you know, it's not about Gaia anymore. It's about Gaius. Everything comes back to the Romans. You know, the Romans, to be a Roman citizen was to put up with a hell of a lot of indignity and, you know, impossible expectations of, you had to throw your life away in service to the empire. You know, you'd have to go away for decades from your family, all that sort of stuff. But you would put up with that, with senators having power of life and death over you, emperors, all the rest. You put up with that because the trade-off was you had power of life and death over your woman and her children and your slaves, you know. It's this that it's this false sort of payoff. It's like, well, you get to enjoy this brutal power relationship as well. You can enjoy the benefits of it if you submit to it. And it's us humans with penises that have made that agreement. And that's all of us, everybody who's been overtaken. You know, we're all refugees from our own homelands and from our own ways of being on this planet, from everything in our DNA that's screaming to live in a certain way. We're refugees from that. We've been displaced, dispossessed, and we're not in our habitat, and we're not in our proper way of being. And men, we've been changed into these monsters, you know. And we are monsters, you know. We've had this created. So feminism is so important. It's probably more important for men than it is for women, you know, in that basically we really need to embrace it and we really need to sort things out. And it's not about losing power. It's about regaining our humanity and therefore regaining our place in the pattern of creation, you know, as really important custodians of creation. We can't do that for as long as this unequal power relation is in place, because it doesn't just enslave our women, it enslaves us.
Exactly. And that's something that is not realized.
We're disempowered by our privilege as men, and that's got to go.
Boy, this is some book, Tyson. I'm so glad to meet you, man.
Me too. I'm just thrilled. I've just been, you know, I've been looking at the ripples, historical ripples coming out from those two men, you know, you know, Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, and the massive impact that's had on the world. I think once you start tracking that, you know, and as an Aboriginal person tracking through history, when you see all of the patterns that's created and the good and the bad, you see that that was a strange attractor and a moment in history. And just to meet somebody who was involved with that is very exciting to me. It makes it very real.
But anyhow, we have to close here. But
yeah,
I have enough. I made enough notes in this book. By the way, here's the book, everybody. I'm going to be in it next show. That's not showing because of my background.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn off my background. Okay, everybody.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, there you go. Thank you. Thank you, Tyson. Anyhow, what I'm trying to say is I got a lot more I want to talk about. So I'm going to let me forget about book promotion and anything. I want to talk to you again. So hopefully you'll be free at some point and we'll get the mic thing fixed up. We'll figure that out. It's just technology.
Yeah.
No problem. So thank you again, Tyson, and everybody. You'll go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. You'll see the show notes, which will have the links to get Tyson's book, which I can't more highly recommend. I don't want to go into a whole promo about it, but I love it. Okay. And I think it has ideas in there that are really crucially important for us, all of us. And so you'll get linked up in every way, Tyson. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you again, Tyson. And next time we'll see you back here. Huh?
Sounds great. All right. Good to meet you, Raghu.
Thank you.